Welcome to Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Strangini. We are in the book of Isaiah. This is chapter 32. Verse 1. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. And a man shall be as an hiding place from the wind, and a covert from the tempest, as rivers of water in a dry place, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. Isaiah has a good number of these prophetic visions of the idealized kingdom, the kingdom that is in obedience to God, ruled over by a king under God who is righteous. Many of the reigns of the kings in which Isaiah prophesied were not good kings. They did not reign in righteousness. And the princes, which are the government officials beneath the king, do not rule in judgment. A lot of, I think, the energy of mankind is taken up with how do we get, good government? How do we get, because we need some sort of government, because mankind left to his own devices in a sort of anarchic state without any government, there's quite a bit of barbarism. And, this gets written into all kinds of movies, and I don't think sometimes it's quite as barbaric as some think, but it would be quite barbaric, quite lawless. There's enough of a lawless impulse in man that if there is no law, many men would become lawless enough so as to create chaos. And it would make it very difficult for people who just wanted to live in peace to live in peace. Those who want to live in peace have to band together and create law. And that's just what that's the way it is with man. So whenever God presents to us this idealized state of how man could live, there is always a righteous government. And the person at the head of that government in the Old Testament would be the Messiah, the Savior, the King whom God has chosen, the heir of David. And of course, in the New Testament, it is revealed that that is Christ. And so these promises here can be regarded as essentially millennial promises of Christ's righteous reign and benevolent rule in righteous judgment. When it says in verse 2 that a man shall be as a hiding place, there's four basic words used in the Old Testament for man. There's Adam, which is it comes from the word that means the ground, Adama, because that's what man, God took man out of the dust of the ground and made Adam. He called him, he named him after what he made him out of. It's meant to refer to all humanity. It's not really a man, it's humans. And then there is another word, Enosh, which refers to man more in the sense of man's depravity and man's weakness. Like we would say, he's just a man. It's because of men. We have one word that kind of, not really one, but I mean, I don't know if we have a word that really takes in Enosh. And Geber, that's also another word, and it usually denotes a mighty man. But this word here, Ish, refers to man in terms of sex. So it means a male. To us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Isaiah chapter 9. So that is the man prophesied, the man who would be as an hiding place from the wind, covert from the tempest. All these pictures of strength and protection. The reference of rivers of waters, you remember in when Christ met the woman at the well, he said, if you asked me, I would give you water to drink that would be in you, a well of water springing up into everlasting life, so that you would never thirst again. And those are the pictures that God uses to draw us into this idea of an idealized state for man, to a state where there is true peace and true justice. Verse 3, and the eyes of them that see shall not be dim, and the ears of them that hear shall hearken. The heart also of the rash shall understand knowledge, and the tongue of the stammerers shall be ready to speak plainly. So, Jesus talked often of, you know, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. The idea of having eyes to see and ears to hear, it is a reference to the notion that it's not just a question of seeing, but of seeing the true nature of something. Like, I could show you some object, like, I guess I have a stapler here on my desk. It's a weird-looking stapler, because it's not the kind you use around the house. It's one for stapling. I was using it to staple some insulation not too long ago. But that's not its only purpose, but it's an odd one. It has a weird triggering mechanism. It's actually backwards. But, you know, someone who'd never been acquainted with this kind of a tool could look at this thing and have no idea what it does, what its function is. You know, but they would still see it. They would still see the object, but they would not understand its purpose. Just like when Jesus would tell a parable. I mean, you could hear the parable. You could hear the story, but not understand what it meant. And so, you know, there are all these things in life where we can, you know, see things but miss it entirely. Sometimes I feel like in our society, or with man in general, in order to have peace, you have to, you know, believe them and not your lying eyes, so to speak. Meaning, you can see something that's going on, but you can't talk about it. I mean, you're not allowed to understand what it really signifies. Or if you do, you have to pay negative social consequences. You know, you talk about the problems in our society. Some of them are okay to talk about or politically correct, and other ones are politically incorrect. And people have to, not have to, but there's pressure on people to avoid talking about uncomfortable subjects or to avoid certain subjects entirely. And you take on a certain social stigma, potentially. Depends on where you live and who you hang out with. It works a lot in church, too, honestly. If you feel like, I don't believe in the rapture, right? Now, I don't mind going to a place where they do. And it's not a subject I have to bring up. I don't feel like I've got this directive from God to go correct everyone on different points of doctrine. But, you know, there is a certain amount of shame, though, in not being able to talk about things. And it's not because, it's because I know, you know, there's certain things you don't talk about because you know it's going to cause trouble. Because people can't handle it. They can't handle disagreement. They can't handle having a spirited discussion. Because, I think in church people are just afraid of any sort of argument because a lot of people can't handle it. I mean, a lot of people in society are very weak. You know, when anything challenges their viewpoint, they start to get really upset. And, you know, I understand what that's like to a degree. I've always been kind of challenging myself. You know, I know on things where I felt like I was really correct and dogmatically so, I don't know. I've never really felt threatened by someone's opinion. You shouldn't feel threatened by someone's opinion. I'm trying to identify with that position, but I really don't. Other people's opinions aren't threatening. But our vision is somewhat dimmed because we're not allowed to speak. That's how I feel sometimes. Because sometimes you can't even talk to people because they're not allowed to hear. And you start talking like that, pretty soon you're not welcome to return. In God's kingdom, our eyes will be open and it will be an undiminished vision of the truth. And the heart of the rash shall understand knowledge. There's a lot of things people do in rash decisions, not based on really any thinking at all. You can make quick decisions, but you shouldn't make rash decisions. Rash are unadvised decisions. That's not based on knowledge, but based on maybe just feelings. You know, it's like, I was offended, and so I started abusing someone. You know, that kind of decision. The tongue of the stammerer shall be ready to speak plainly. It's those who stutter. I stutter sometimes. I don't have the problem. I don't want to diminish their real struggle against stuttering, but, I mean, I admire people who can speak without having a bit of a stutter in their language. Sometimes it's hard to make your point. You know, I'm always very conscious of difficulties I have in speaking because I get lazy. I'm thinking, but my words are not always right up in the same space. Wouldn't it be nice if we could all speak plainly? And that idea comes from the root meaning of sort of dazzling or bright, which means it's something evident. You know, like I say stuff and you get it. And I am not struggling to try to explain what it means. Verse 5. The vile person shall no more be called liberal, nor the churl said to be bountiful. For the vile person will speak villainy, and his heart will work iniquity, to practice hypocrisy, and to utter error against the Lord, to make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. Their instruments also of the churl are evil. He deviseth wicked devices to destroy the needy. He deviseth wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. But the liberal deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand. We're going to start with verse 5. The vile person. Vile, in this sense, means vulgar. The vulgar person will no longer be called liberal or noble. A lot of times we mistake vulgarity for liberality, meaning just giving people whatever they want is not true noble liberality. Do whatever you want, you know, like as a parent. Like, let's say I'm going to be really liberal with my kids. And I think I am actually pretty liberal on things that don't matter, things that aren't important. I tend to take a very open perspective. On things that do matter, such as respect, such as obedience, I'm extremely strict. I'm not liberal at all. But I don't think that's a sign of illiberality. What it is I'm not vulgar. I don't encourage my children to do evil things. Yeah, I want to encourage them to do good things. You know, because look at here. I'm gonna skip out on the churl for now. Just focus on what it says about the vile person in all these verses. A vile person speaks villainy, and his heart works iniquity to practice hypocrisy, to utter error against the Lord, to make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. And then it says about the liberal in verse 8, that the liberal deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand. Or the nobleman devises truly noble things. That's the implication. And by the nobility of those actions, by those truly liberal things, or noble would probably be better, just because we have so much, the idea of liberal in our mindset, we think too much in political terms. Like it being a very giving person is a very liberal characteristic. And maybe I should go into the difference. Like we think of liberalism as tax and spend. Being liberal with someone else's money is not exactly the kind of true nobility we're talking about. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to be liberal in a lot of different ways. You know, just like this word, which is nabal, is translated fool from time to time. But there are other words for fool, like there's evil or evil. I forget exactly how to pronounce it, but it's spelled evil, but it's evil or something like that, which means like kind of a sluggard, slothful. The other one, which was, but it means, there's a third one that means like something that someone's like dense or stupid. But this is vulgar. Vulgarism as opposed to liberality. Because it could be mistaken. You know, some people think liberalism is, well, we allow people to say crude things on television. That's not liberality. That's vulgarity. See? And so, allowing my children to I don't know, what do I do? I always think of like a way I let them jump on their beds. That's kind of liberality. I mean, it's not a great example, you know what I mean? But then allowing the children to eat as much junk food as they want, or allowing the children to, you know, watch things they shouldn't watch on television, or to totally explore the internet, you know, without any supervision or any thought about what they might find there. You know, that is not liberality. You're opening the door. You're being vulgar. You're not caring about anything that matters. But I think in our society, we do tend to think that vulgarity is liberality. I'm just going to be totally open with my kids and the way I raise them, and open with the people around me. You know, I'm so liberal. I guess I can't get away from the thought of a political liberality, and I start dwelling into that. But I want to stay away. I want to think about in someone's personal life. But, you know, this is a lot of political stuff here. In politics, I don't want to talk about Democrats, Republicans, or liberal versus conservative, because, you know, what we call a liberal today, you know, I mean, 50 years ago, someone who was called a liberal would be called conservative by today's standards, especially on social issues. 50 years ago, is that good enough? Maybe I need to go back. See, yeah, even 50 years ago, back in the 60s, sure. 60s was actually, contrary to people's thought, it was a very conservative decade. It was the, at the end of that decade, the revolt against that conservatism, which brought on the debauchery of the 70s. The decade in which I was born. But true liberality is going to be something that is looking for the best outcome for people. It's not just going to get stuck on what, you know, one way of thinking necessarily, but it's going to look for the best solution. It's some form of generosity, which seemed to be, you know, to help people, turned out to be a big disaster. You know, a truly liberal person is not going to want to continue that. They're going to want to do something to fix the problem they created. And I am thinking political. But anyways, the point is that these contradictions in terms, where you have the liberal being called, or the vulgar person being called liberal for some reason, and you have the churl, which is like the miser, the greedy person being called bountiful or rich. And we call them the rich. Even the rich now has a negative connotation in our society. So the idea of someone being enriched is not always like this bad thing. He grew wealthy and powerful. You know, it's not supposed to be negativity necessarily automatically. Like liberal here, it's not supposed to be some negative idea like we have today. If you were calling someone bountiful or rich, you were complimenting them. He's a wealthy man. It's like, he's not wealthy. He's just stingy. Yeah, he isn't creating wealth so much as he's just shepherding every resource to himself. There's no bounty with this person. He's merely a churl. So the vile person will speak villainy. It means do error, mistake, impiety, injury. That's what vulgarity speaks, things that are undesirable. You know, we even have the term vulgarity of certain kinds of language, vulgar language. And their hearts work iniquity, to practice hypocrisy, to utter error against the Lord. They're always speaking against God and God's ways. They always want to go away from the pure things of God. They hate those things. Like the liberality of being faithful to your wife, the self-sacrificing necessary, and vice versa, of course. Yeah, I mean, but when you commit to somebody and they commit to you, that mutual exchange of self-sacrifice, mutual. It shouldn't be all one way. The woman's got to sacrifice too, and the man, and all that. This mutual idea, when it's at its best, is of mutual liberality towards the other. But vulgar people in our society are always working against that. And they destroy things. And they think, well, it's more liberal to be able to just be with whoever you want, and as many people as you want, as often as you want, or all at the same time. That's being liberal. Just do whatever you want. No, that's being vulgar. There's nothing noble about that. There's nothing ennobling about degradation. It's a practice hypocrisy. Say, well, they're not hypocritical, are they, Paul? I don't know. I heard out in vulgar Hollywood recently that all the so-called liberal, vulgar people out there who say they are in favor, you know, they respect women so much, have been doing vulgar things with unwilling people, you know? Oh, these are the enlightened ones. They are so enlightened and they are so in favor of women's advancement as they abuse them and lure them and promise them, advancement in exchange for, favors sexually and all that. And they're vulgar people. They're not liberals in the classic sense. There's nothing noble about them. And in their hypocrisy, they speak against God and the people of God as if we are the hypocrites. I know there's always hypocrisy hanging around, right? There's always people pretending to be religious and being hypocritical about it. There's also people pretending to be liberal, pretending to serve one thing or the other. You know, there's always hypocrisy in man. The idea that it's somehow that religious people have a monopoly on hypocrisy. To make empty the soul of the hungry, and he would cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. See, that's an analogy, the idea of hunger and drink, that the substance which you really need. This is the thing about the liberality. They say, oh, we're going to help everybody. We're going to make everybody free. And they drag everyone into bondage so that people's souls are not filled with what they need. You know what I mean? The man's soul becomes empty in all the degradation and all the pleasure seeking, all the hedonism that in this world that those who claim the mantle of liberalism engage in, these vulgar people, and they encourage it in others, and they empty people's souls, so we become these empty shells of just perversity, iniquity, sin, and vulgarity. And we become these disgusting caricatures of man. We're not men, we're dogs, is what we become. The instruments also of the churl are evil. It's evil ra'ah, in the sense of breaking up that which is good. Yeah, he's not creating riches or wealth. Because there's different kinds of rich people. You gotta understand. There are people who are just grasping, grabbing, greedy people. They take in money, but they don't produce anything. Except maybe corruption, crime, extortion, bribery. You know, those kind of products. I'm not talking about someone who through hard work, you know, they make a factory, they employ people, they produce a product, or they create a new innovation, and then it creates a whole market for people, and other people prosper. That someone who's truly bountiful and rich is benefiting people around them. It doesn't have to be that he's just giving it all away, but he's creating things for other people. That's a bountiful person. But then you see some of these people, they get, how come it is when our leaders, when they come out of leadership positions, they go right to some cushy job, or maybe they just collect speaking fees, walking around talking about who knows what. They left the country in a mess, and now they're going off speaking and getting paid millions of dollars. You know, they go into office, they're not rich, but they come out leaving the country worse off than it was, and they walk away and they're suddenly millionaires. Probably might have a guess of some of the people I might be talking about. But I'm just thinking, those are examples I know of. People, like, they don't produce anything except, you know, scandals, except misery around the world, pushing issues that aren't liberal but are vulgar. They push vulgarity and corrupt our society, and they're getting rich. So what does the churl do? He deviseth wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. You know, Isaiah had something in his mind. I'm not familiar with his society on the detail level. But in our society, they devise wicked devices to separate people from their money. But there are people out there who just are completely there to fleece you, you know? Like, I think about, I think one time there was like a, years ago, I fell for this scam where it was like, it made it seem like you would get a job at the post office. And they put it in the little newspaper, local newspaper. And they say, you know, postal jobs now and blah, blah, blah. And you call and they give you the impression that it's, you're going to get training to become a postal worker. Decent job, right? I mean, I'm not interested in it now. But, you know, I was at the time, I thought, like, oh, I needed a job, and I thought, this is a possibility. But they wanted, like, $100, and I was stupid enough to pay it. And they sent me this stupid, you know, little workbook, basically, about, like, just informational and stuff. But it wasn't anything towards getting a job. It was basically they deceived me. You know, they deceived me to get my money, and I was in a rough spot. And, you know, they were trying to find people who were desperate and wanted a job or something like that, you know, and when they find you in that situation, they give you a little bit of hope and then just ask for some money, take it, and they walk, go their way. You know, and I remember it's just post office, blah, you know, I was calling about the job. And they're like, yes, you can get a postal job. They lied. There are all kinds of scams in little newspapers all across America. I can think about a lot of religious leaders, too, like the Word of Faith movement. You know, send your money in. You know, Robert Tilton. Hey, he's nothing now. He's like just yesterday's news, right? Robert Tilton. So who's another money grubber? Well, a lot on that TBN, was that the station where they had a lot of the money grubbing, you know, send your seed money in and be blessed and all that. You know, they pray upon you, need, are you desperate for money? Well, send it to me. Evil. So we cover verse 8 essentially. The liberal deviseth liberal things, by liberal things shall he stand, by truly noble things. A truly noble person is not going to be vulgar. He's going to devise liberal things. He's not going to devise villainy and practice hypocrisy and utter error against the Lord. Yeah, that's the modern liberalism. A lot of it is like against God, against the truth. Killing babies isn't a liberal position. It's a vulgar position. Listen sometime to some comedian talking, about, if they dare. There's some who do. And I heard one talking about abortion. And he was just admitting that it was definitely, he started talking about it's either like having a bowel movement or it's killing a baby. Because those are really the only two positions. And he just started thinking about it aloud, and it was supposed to be funny. And in a way it was, I guess, because the sheer honesty of the horror of what he was saying. But he's basically saying, like, it's definitely killing a baby. And he's saying, I guess I'm in favor of killing babies. And that's about the most honest, vulgar position you could take. It's incredibly vulgar. Being liberal is more like, let's help these women either avoid pregnancy or find some way to give up their baby or just counsel them that it's not so bad to have a baby. Babies will bring a lot of happiness into your life. Who's responsible for this pregnancy? Find the guy? What? I don't know. There's a lot of more liberal policies we could take rather than shooting right to the vulgarity of let's kill it. Verse 9. Rise up, ye women that are at ease. Hear my voice, ye careless daughters. Give ear unto my speech. Many days and years shall ye be troubled, ye careless women. For the vintage shall fail, the gathering shall not come. Tremble, ye women that are at ease. Be troubled, ye careless ones. Strip you and make you bare. And gird sackcloth upon your loins. They shall lament for the teats, the pleasant fields for the fruitful vine. Upon the land of my people shall come up thorns and briars, yea, upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city. Because the palaces shall be forsaken, the multitude of the city shall be left, the forts and towers shall be for dens forever, a joy of wild asses and a pasture of flocks. Until. And I'll just leave it right there. Verse 15 goes to until, but I need a little here on the subject of the women here. Now, you know, they put women directly. But just as a lot of things that are written for men are also for all mankind, and sometimes women are put for the whole population, because the ease, comfort, and luxury of the women can also be the ease, comfort, and luxury of the men. But we will use women as an example. And when it says, you women that are at ease, ye careless daughters, it means confident. And what does he say? You're going to be troubled. The vintage shall fail. The gatherings shall not come. Basically, hard times ahead. The pleasant fields, the fruitful vine are going to fail. Prosperous times are going to go away. The good things of life are going away. The women of our time are full of cares. They are notable, some would say, for confidence, but also, right, for, what do they say, women are have low self-esteem. So they attempt to build themselves up in things in order to gain confidence. They got to paint their nails. They got to paint their faces. They got to have their hair done. You know, they got to have the right clothes. They got the right furniture, wallpaper, the decorations of the home. They got to portray this picture of prosperity, project this confidence. It says, I have it all together. Right? And to be socially accepted, you got to watch the right television shows. We got, when you post your picture on Facebook, everyone's got to click the like button. Got to read the latest novels. Yeah, you got to make sure your hair, if there's any gray, you got to color it. Remodel the house. Go out to dinner. Call your girlfriends on the phone and gossip. Find out the latest celebrity news. Buy new clothes. Go out and party with your friends. Right? Built up in the world, confident, looking after the things of this life. New shoes, new car, new purse, new husband. Huh. The women today are so confident, they don't even need a husband. They don't need a man. Children need men in their lives. It's very important. Much more important than anyone realizes. Well, there are people who realize, but these types who say, oh, it can be done, just oh, you don't need a man, it's not important. You're wrong. Men have a very important role, because men and women are not the same. They're not interchangeable. When you take away the bull elephants, the young male elephants, they go out of control, they start killing. You raise children without male influences, they're going to be just as screwed up. I need a vacation. I need to relax. I need some wine. They're very careful. They draw all their confidence from possessing those things. And if they don't possess those things, they're troubled. But if they don't possess all the things that they say women need to have to be what? To be worthwhile, to have a life worth living, to be happy. You know, but the most important things they're not careful about, that they need to pray, to talk to the Lord, to seek Him, to be content with what they have, to study the Scriptures, to conform to the image of Christ, to please their husbands. A lot of women, pleasing their husbands is the furthest thing from their minds. Oh, well, he's got to please me. There's nothing wrong with that, but what about the other side of it? It's got to be reciprocal. If there's no reciprocity, that's not fair. It's worse than not fair. It's monstrous. You know, just to seek your own pleasure. And how your husband feels, well, you know, and not just to please, but to serve. Men are expected to serve, you know. Men, it's like we have great burdens on us. You know, a man has basically one way that's, you know, socially acceptable for him to get through life, really. A man is supposed to sacrifice and work his tail off and give it all for his woman, his wife, and his children and all that, right? And if a man doesn't do that, if he decides, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to look out for myself. Well, people get offended. If he actually states that as a point, like, I'm just going to go my own way. However, women just say, well, I don't need a man. I'm just going to raise a child on my own. Oh, she's applauded. What a hero. What a hero. It's no wonder that men don't want to get married these days. The idea of service for a woman is utterly alien. He's the one who's supposed to serve. Her, the idea of service, well, what are you talking about? Patriarchy, blah, blah, blah. That's like men have obligations, women have obligations. There's got to be a give and take. Expect a man to do all these things, to remain in the same role, while they are, oh, they're free to do whatever they want. If they don't like him, they can just kick him out of the house and take half of everything he has for the rest of his life. Everything he's worked for, everything he's built, and he could take the children, all of that. Do we, are the careless women, how do I guide my children down good paths? I don't need a man, I'll just leave it up to the state. I'll just shuffle my children off to school, you careless women. I'm going to be a good neighbor. What can I do to others to serve others? How can I serve the Lord? You know, these are the things they're not careful about. They don't seek to draw confidence from them. But if they knew, if they did, if they could see what they lacked, they would see their nakedness. They would see their utter destitution. And all the things they've put their trust in. The bad times are coming. The vintage shall fail. The gathering shall not come. It's funny, I used to equate that to the rapture. The gathering in the sky, it isn't coming. And although this is a picture of disappointment, I don't think that's what it's talking about. Not even in a typological sense. But I certainly think there are Old Testament scriptures that can be used in a typological sense to speak of false prophetic expectations. So tremble, you women that are at ease, be troubled. You should be troubled. It should trouble us. But they don't know enough to be troubled in their complacency. They're so complacent in the way the world is ordered for them. From, you know, and it's not just, you know, I mentioned unwed mothers, but even wives. That's why a lot of men are trying to avoid getting married, because it's such a bad deal. But men can be just like this. Men can be just as bad. But right now we're talking about women. Careless ones. Gird sackcloth upon your loins. You notice sackcloth is not in the Hebrew. It's italics in the King James. They're applying it. You know, gird up your loins. Which is, I always take that as a sort of a, get ready for what's coming. You know? And if it's time to stop being careless and at ease, it is to put on sackcloth. It's time to mourn. They're going to lament for the teats, the breasts. Now, what does that mean in that context, though? I don't think they mean their own breasts. Like, if through hunger they can't produce milk. Or is it in a sense of a play on words, like, these women are content and at ease, and they're kind of like babies. You know, and I think a lot of modern women are like babies. In fact, even the way they use makeup on their faces is to sort of make themselves, make their eyes bigger. Why is that? Well, babies have big eyes relative to the size of their body. Children's eyes are bigger. You know, their faces are childlike. A lot of the techniques women use, it is always to preserve youth and to try to appeal to some sort of instinctive protection mechanism. You know, they want to stay on the teat. They just want to suckle. They don't want to contribute. Whether it's living off benefits, of the government or living off a man without contributing. You read the woman in Proverbs, at the end of Proverbs. She's industrious. I thank God I have an industrious wife who works hard all the time. I always get offended when people say, oh, your wife doesn't work. I'm like, you're out of your mind. She doesn't work at a conventional job. Well, it's like saying my children don't go to school just because they don't go to a conventional school. There's work being done. There's learning. They don't want to come off. They don't want to stop being babies and being babied. The materialism of our society and of the women of our society and the obsession with things and obtaining and new things and, you know, vacations, parties, all those things I mentioned, you know, the things that make them feel good and complacent and at ease in their lives are all the things that are against them. And when it's taken away, oh, how they will lament. The pleasant fields and the fruitful vine. These are metaphors for prosperity and wealth. And he's saying, upon the land of my people shall come up thorns and briars. Upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city. Remember, he's looking forward to the Assyrian invasion. So there's not going to be all the prosperous harvest. The land's going to be so decimated, there's not going to be harvest. There's going to be briars and thorns. There's going to be wild animals living in the cities. That's what he says in verse 14. They're going to be for dens, the forts and towers, right? The multitude of the cities shall be left. The forts and towers shall be for dens forever. A joy of wild asses and a pasture of flocks. Now notice the word forever. It's forever. Some people say forever is forever. Well, forever, verse 15, until. What it means is continually, and it's a figure of speech. It doesn't necessarily mean for, you know, eternity. A lot of times people take things that are in the scripture more literally than they're intended. You know, just like this whole picture of like, you know, they will lament for the teats. We could take that literally. It'd be hard to tell what it meant. Maybe they're going to have mastectomies? Mastectomies? I don't know. You know, whatever. But that doesn't seem to be what it's saying here. Though, I know in ancient times some barbaric invaders would do that. You know, that would be a way of, some scripture where it talks about, you know, they will pluck off their breasts. There's mutilations. We could talk about mutilation. I don't think that's what it's really talking about here. It's obvious in the context that this is put for the easy living, you know? And it's fairly obvious. Until the Spirit be poured out upon us from on high. Verse 15. Until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. See, the idea of the field. There's a lot of, in the teachings of Christ in his parables, there's always like the field is the world and they go forth into the field and they plant things, right? A certain man had a field and he bought it and he sold it, and etc. There's a lot of fields. And here it's put for the prosperity of the nation. And we're saying that they're complacent in their prosperity. And they're going to be punished for that complacency because they do not mind the things of God. They instead, you know, there's wicked devices. There's iniquity being practiced and error against the Lord. And God is going to punish this. And he's going to bring this devastation down. But he's going to, after this is all finished with, he's going to pour out his Spirit. And this is a pattern that's familiar with throughout the prophets. And it can be even in our lives. You know, sometimes there's destruction and then our lives are rebuilt and God pours out his Spirit and he renews us. And the thing about it in Christ is you don't have to wait for the whole nation to come around. In the midst of devastation, you can be blessed. In the midst of all things coming apart at the seams, you can have the peace of God through the Spirit of God, which comes in the name of Jesus Christ. And then all our wildernesses are fruitful fields. And the things that were fruitful are kind of for a forest. Well, you know, did you notice that reversal of fortunes there? The wilderness becomes a fruitful field, and the fruitful field becomes a forest. The things that they were careful for in this world, you know, all the worldly things I mentioned, like the women get caught up in, that fruitful field is going to become devastated. But at the same time, that opens the door to having a different field come into fruit. Something that was a wilderness, something that was ignored and neglected. They neglected the things of God. God punished them. And that opens their eyes. Often it opens people's eyes to what really matters in this life. You know, a man's life and worth does not consist of the multitude of his possessions. So, that which was once desolate becomes fruitful. Praying becomes fruitful. Seeking God becomes fruitful. Contentedness in the things of God and the things he has provided becomes fruitful, as opposed to all this covetousness and all this avaricious greed and desiring to have things which are not profitable nor necessary for life. And then judgment will dwell in the wilderness and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. That throughout everything, that which has become a wilderness, the righteousness and judgment of God is going to be over all. The important things, the areas where we want to be fruitful, we want righteousness and judgment to dominate over those things. And in the things that we don't want to be fruitful, we still want righteousness and judgment to rule over all those things. You know, and as we exist in the world, you know, there are necessary things. It just uses a simple idea of, you know, a fruitful field. It's just an analogy for the things that bring them contentment in life. And they rely on those things to be content. But if we rely on God to be content, we can also have those things in life which are necessary, and they will, and we will be sustained in them as much as it is necessary. But we're not going to be so fruitful in them necessarily either. You know what I mean? Or if we are fruitful in them, our attitude towards them may be quite different. You know, because a liberal man deviseth liberal things. A truly noble person, possessed of much wealth, has a great burden of, what shall I do with all this wealth? And what would God have me do with having given me so much? And that's something that must be sought in the other field, in prayer, in seeking God's will. So, let's see. We are, the work of righteousness shall be peace, verse 17. And the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. So there we have the work of righteousness, the effect of righteousness, peace, quietness, and assurance forever. And again, it's also, it's forever if you continue in it. You know, if we keep the faith. I don't really believe that you can lose your salvation, but I do believe that people who say they have faith can be found to have not really been of faith, but rather they just made a claim and then there was no real root in them, like as Jesus uses in the parable of the sower. Now, they had not root in themselves and problems come along and they soon wither away. So, you know, if we continue in his goodness, we will have his goodness. If we turn our backs on him, then we're not going to have it. Because I always believe that the work of salvation in our lives keeps us directed towards God. That's how it's worked for me. There have been times when my faith would go to a low ebb, where I would have doubts, misgivings, and the Lord always kept me oriented towards him. Even when I would feel like I wanted to give up, I just about wanted to give up. I just couldn't. So I know what it's like to come to the edge of losing your faith. And then to step back from the precipice. It's because I just can't go. Can't go. Can't take that plunge. Because the Lord has too strong a hold on me. But when we stay within that zone of the work of God's righteousness and the effect that Jesus has on our lives, we can reap these fruits. Peace. Quietness. Quietness is, you know, it's funny, I wrote down this definition years ago. It means to repose, usually figuratively, assurance. So quietness apparently means assurance, which is the word we have in the next verse. I always think this is funny in the King James, when it's like, assurance means quietness, and quietness means assurance, actually. But, yeah, my note on assurance says that it means trust or confidence. These are synonyms for confidence, assurance. The word careless was confidence, you know. We can find the peace, the ease. Woe to you women that are at ease. It's not that there's something wrong with being at peace, but what is bringing us peace? That's the question. From what do we draw our peace? Do we draw our peace from the wicked ways of the world? You know, as we pursue, you know, these things that seem innocuous, you know, like I said, women and their nails and their hair, and what's wrong with all that? Well, you know, they're doing all that, but they regard not the works of the Lord. They utter error against the Lord, leaving souls empty. You know, and among Christian women, this is still a big problem. It's not just like, oh, it's all the ungodly. Well, most of America is Christian anyways. We're the ungodly. And this is a Christian nation for the majority. So there's a lot of Christians getting caught up in these things. At least they're declared Christians. Like I always say, if someone says they're a Christian, they're a Christian. I don't go around judging whether or not someone's a Christian. If they deny Christ, then all right, you're not a Christian. If you say, I rejected Christ, I'm not a Christian anymore. I say, okay, I'm not going to argue with you. Well, if someone says they're a Christian until they prove otherwise, and even then, I don't judge anything. If they still tell me they believe. Fine. Until tribulation and persecution comes along and they deny the Lord, or until the judgment of God, when they stand before God and he says no, you're not allowed to just feign faith and then walk into my kingdom unprepared. You know, until he says that, until the Lord come and make that judgment, I don't make it. All right? But I can tell people where the problems are. I've had problems in my life with sin and iniquity. It's not like it's like something I'm not familiar with. It's not like something we can't overcome. But we have to see the problem for what it is, and we have to be able to address it and in order to find a solution. Verse 18. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation and sure and in sure dwellings and in quiet resting places. When it shall hail coming down on the forest, and the city shall be low in a low place. Blessed are ye that sow beside all waters, that send forth thither the feet of the ox and the ass. So that is a little confusing to me, especially that 19th verse about the hail. I mean, you know, that to me right there sounds like some sort of, well, I don't know. I'm not going to claim it's like, I don't understand it. Let me put it that way. Because I do not understand it, I'm sort of like struggling. And maybe this is a bad translation. The hail hailing on the forest. So, because it doesn't seem to be a negative thing. My people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Here's what I get out of that. I remember when I looked this passage over before I was going to teach, I'm like, I don't understand this. And I pray the Lord would give me understanding. And I guess the understanding just sort of popped into my head. They're going to dwell in sure dwellings and quiet resting places. And so when it hails, the city shall be low in a low place. I guess my sense of that I don't understand what the low in a low place means. I think it refers to a sense of security, like not exposed. They're going to dwell in sure dwellings. They're not going to be afraid of severe weather. You know, we're going to the analogies of the fruitful field and then the city that was vulnerable and destroyed and taken over by animals. Well, now the hail is coming down on the forest and the city is low in a low place. It's like nestled down in the valley. It is protected from the storm. I think a hail is often put in the biblical, when you're talking about somewhat, not symbolic, but like metaphorical, or not even metaphorical, I guess the word would be, the type of figure of speech where you put, you know, like hail is put there in place of a severe storm. Like it's idiomatic of a severe storm. Like we would say a severe thunderstorm. For them, a hailstorm may have been their idea of a really bad storm. That's what I'm getting from it. If there's a really bad storm, the city is low in a low place. When in the Bible, the high places are like bad places, you know? Like they did all this on the high places. So I guess the idea of low either indicates... I guess it doesn't indicate this, but from my mind, it's the opposite of high place. It's in a low place. High places are like, you know, where they're trying to make their religious thing. There was only one place to worship God in the Old Testament, so there were no need of all these high places. And honestly, in the New Testament, now the fact that, you know, God now seeks people to worship him, neither in Jerusalem nor in this mountain, but in spirit and in truth. I mean, that is the lowest of low places, the lowest baseline of what God wants from us. The Spirit is poured out in verse 15. Until we have the Spirit, we can, in the Spirit, you know, our habitable place, the place where we have peace, is not this high place, the citadel, the fortress, but rather a low place in the forest. It's protected and sheltered. A baseline of contact with God that is on the individual level. And that's what I'm getting from the gist of these verses, that my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, in sure dwellings, in quiet resting places, when it shall hail coming down on the forest, and the city shall be low in a low place. Notice, hail coming down is a figure of speech in Hebrew. They're repeating it. Hail, hailing. The city shall be low in a low place. It shall hail, hailing, the city shall be low in a low. So there's something poetic being said. That's what I'm saying. This is more metaphorical of the security and peace and prosperity that can be had if we focus on the things of God first. Spirit and truth, the baseline of our worship of God rather than high places. At least that's what I'm getting right here now. 20. I already read this. But blessed are ye that sow beside all waters, that send forth thither the feet of the ox and the ass. And I think that blessing is going to the idea of when the Spirit is poured upon us, when we sow. You know, when it said in verse 2 that the king that would reign would be as... one, a covert from the tempest. Tempest and hail are often in the same breath. And rivers of water in a dry land. So we have the hail in the previous verse, and then we have the idea of the rivers of waters. Basically, that we should cast in our lot with this righteous king that Isaiah prophesied would come. That we should sow to the Lord Jesus Christ. We should, in the Spirit and according to truth, look for peace, habitations, look for our contentedness and our assurance in him. He is the one who promised that if we asked of him of water to drink, he would give us in ourselves a well of water, a spring of water, welling, springing up into everlasting life. And that is, if those who direct people, you know, the sheep of God's pasture, the ox and the ass, the dumb beast, which is symbolic of all of us as we wander our ways. You know, that our husbandry in Christ is prosperous when we send people, but it prospers. We will send people to him. Preach the gospel. I guess that's what I look at this verse 20 as a gospel affirmation. Blessed are you who sow the word of God, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ, and send forth into that and to direct people to that gospel. In any case, that is how I interpret this passage in light of the gospel of Jesus Christ for this modern time. This has been Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Strangini. I thank you for joining me. You can find all my Bible studies. They're all freely downloadable on oraclesofgod.org, oraclesofgod.org. There's book studies. There are single subject studies. There's a lot of material there that I hope will be a blessing to you. Thank you for joining me in this study. I look forward to studying with you again very soon.